Okay, sound check, good, we're on. Okay, let me bring this out, and this out, and this out. Welcome to the Skagit Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We will begin with the greeting, with the opening words. We are a gathered community of free and curious people, children and adults, committed to liberty, justice, compassion, and joy. We are here with the intention to worship, to learn, to speak, to hear, to rest, to celebrate, and to mourn together. We are brave and we are afraid. We are confident and we are uncertain. We are wise and ignorant, righteous and not always so. We are graceful and often we are clumsy. We are here willingly for the work and play of a lifetime, to proclaim what is beautiful and true and good, and to help each other respond in faith, through love, with hope, to the great claims of these upon us.
As we light the chalice, if you could just recite along with me these words by the late Charles Wright. It's on your order of service on the face page. Home is what you lie in or hang above, the house your father made or keeps on making, the dirt you moisten, the sap you push up and nourish. I enter the living room. It too, unfinished, its far wall not there, opening onto a radiance I can't begin to imagine. A light my father walks from, approaching me, dragging his right leg, rolling his plans into a perfect curl. That light, he mutters, that light, we can't keep it out. It keeps on filling your room. Let's move now to hymn number 95, There Is More Love Somewhere. reminder that this evening is the evening for our duties for Family Promise. It's just going to be a very full house there this evening, and it's always kind of uplifting both to enjoy the camaraderie of your fellow congregants, but also to meet the people who are there and to remind yourself of how wonderful people are even under the most difficult and trying of circumstances. Also, on the first, second, and third, I believe, Sundays of each month now, we're having our children's religious education beginning at noon so that the children will have an opportunity to sit through our services and their parents can as well. And anyone who wants to is invited to participate in the religious education program. On the 12th, which is a Saturday, I believe, there will be the 12th of January, there will be another rally at Planned Parenthood at 1805 Division Street from 11 to 12 o'clock. Other announcements, if you have a particularly fetching photograph of one of our events, or if you just want to submit a poem or just a reflection to our announcements, please just mail it to the general mailbox and we'll find a way to slip it in there. Next Sunday on January 6th, we will have Reverend Tom Bozeman speaking to us on growing into harmony. It will be another one of those presentations which will expand our understanding of what Unitarian Universalism is about. Are there any other announcements? Tracy, you had an announcement? Yeah. What is the announcement? Never mind. Hello. Hello, everybody. Okay. That's a very nice announcement. Thank you. This is a community above all, and as in the old 19th century communities, it's a bit of a rural community, and coming together once a week is a way of knitting the community back together again and catching up on news. So it's a great favor to everyone, to our sense of belonging, when people come up and share both the good news and the bad news of their lives. And if it would relieve you or delight you to share some news with us, we invite you to come up and share your joys and sorrows with us right now. You can select an appropriate bead from here and put it in the water as you do so. So just line up on either side if anyone has anything to contribute.
Well, as most of you know, I was in a three-car collision, and my car was totaled. And this was very upsetting to me, of course, because we'd been friends so long, and I have no idea how to buy a car or any of the ins and outs of the mechanics of it. But I had the luck to have friends in this congregation who were very, very helpful, particularly Laura. Laura drove me around and made sure that everything was fine. We went out to Big Lake yesterday. I bought a car. I have fingers crossed that it's going to be a good car. It's a nice car for me, in spite of the NRA sticker on the back window. I have to work on it. I have no idea how anything works on the car except stop and go. I don't know how to turn the heater on. I've got the windshield wipers kind of down and the turning the lights on and off, but that's about it. But so many of you reached out to me, and I'm very grateful. Ken called me and he said, you know, what can I do? I'll help you pay for your loaner car, and which I thought was wonderful. And but that'll go back today, and it'll still be on the insurance. So this congregation is a wonderful congregation, if you haven't found that out yet. It's absolutely marvelous to be with all of you, and I want to thank you for that.
Hi, I'm Nancy Miller, and seems like I'm the Mary Poppins for my brother and his wife over in Gig Harbor. 3 years ago, I went over there and helped change that the doctors were misdiagnosing him and he was going to pass away, and we prevented that from happening, and he got a new valve in his heart. And now he's back going to the gym 3 times a week, etc. But they have no children, so every Christmas their tradition is to get on a cruise ship and just sail away from it all. And so this year the power was out when they tried to back the car out to get to the SeaTac, and the plane was late. And when they got there, the people on the shuttles had already left for the ship. So he said, I should have listened, I should have listened. First night on the ship, they're going to their wonderful dinner, and his wife slips and falls on the marble stairs and snaps her hip, and it goes up into the buttock area about 5 inches. And this is not good when you're out at sea. Luckily, there was a physician on board and lots of morphine, so they got disembarked him at Cabo San Lucas. And my brother wanted to medevac her back to Seattle, and she said, no, fix it now, it hurts. We're very basic. And so fixed it now. Then they flew back. We got him back to Gig Harbor, and then to a hospital that really wasn't taking good care of her. She developed bed sores and in 2 days. So we found a Taj Mahal of rehab centers. We got her in it. She's going to make it in spite of herself. So, yay. And I'm home.
What a story to follow. I'm Norma Jean. I'm new to you, kind of, sort of. And you know how you get busy serving, doing other things, and you forget yourself? Ooh, I might cry. Today is the 33rd anniversary of my service as a Reiki master.
Congratulations.
I'm Ken Stern, and Wednesday I'm going to fly down to Oakland and Marin County, where my brother Phil lives, and we're going to get together for the third time this year. I haven't seen my brother Phil 3 times in the last 13 years, so there's hope. So that's a joy. But my sorrow, of course, is I'm going to miss you all next Sunday.
Hi, I'm Kathy Roche Zuko, and this is going to sound so minor, but it delighted me. As you all know, I sing with Cantabile, and long story made very short, you know how hard it is to reach an audience and how to make an audience. But a friend of mine who I happened to have lunch with on Friday works at Facebook. Like, he's a major player at Facebook. And he is taking over the whole Cantabile website, Facebook. He's going to be giving us hundreds of dollars every month of publicity on Facebook. And he's going to do it all because he likes me. And I am just delighted. So yay Cantabile and yay Kevin.
Hi, I'm Greg. So I wasn't here last week. I was traveling I had a bit of a dream come true. One of my college professors is he's a fiddle player and up in central New York, and he's had a lifetime of doing ethnomusicology in the area and also writing fiddle tunes. And I was asked for by name to play on a recording that that's being done of his music. So I got to spend. So the good news, I went by myself back to Western New York. Met my parents there, got to spend a few days in my old college town playing music that I did during my formative years. I got to spend Christmas Eve with my extended family. I got to fly home on Christmas Day, which was a little crazy. I missed Christmas morning with my kids, but then Christmas afternoon was just good. So this is for, I guess, all the safe travel that I had and all the family, and especially for my family here in Washington that made it possible for me to jet away during a stressful time of year.
Good morning. I'm Mike. I'd just like to drop a pebble for several things. We had a wonderful Christmas dinner. Laura's superb at her barbecue, and we all had a dinner for us church orphans with no extended family in the area, so we had quite a group at the house. And I'm glad Laura was able to help Rosemary with her car. I'm glad we're back to dropping pebbles and joys and concerns, because that's what all this is about, is community, and without this particular portion, it doesn't have much meaning. So thank you. And let's stay with it.
Thank you, Mike.
And for all the joys and sorrows which remain unexpressed.
And next we're going to do an offering and meditation. I've never done this before, so I may need somebody to prompt me to know what I'm supposed to do with the baskets and when I do them. But I want to start by saying, there we go, that we have all been warmed by fires we did not make, but fires cannot burn without fuel. The time, the energy, the imagination, the vision, the creativity, the compassion, and the love of the members and friends of this community all fuel our mission and nurture and sustain a welcoming, inclusive, diverse, liberal, religious community. And so does our financial support for this physical space where we make our spiritual home. If you are visiting or returning after an absence or otherwise constrained, please let the offering basket pass you by. After the offering is done, we will have a brief meditation. Okay, now please stand in body or spirit and join in hymn number 90, From All the Fret and Fever of the Day. Okay, and now we're going to have a few words about the blessings of bad times. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. The approaching end of the year is often a time for reflection, recalling the best and worst of this passing year and looking ahead to the coming year. It is easy enough to recall the high points of this year, and it's very human to want to put the difficult and unpleasant hard times behind us. But before we leave the memories of the hard times behind us completely, in this service we will share some reflections on them. We will explore hard times in company with Charles Dickens, Mark Twain, Jane Austen, Douglas Adams, the movie Jaws, Rachel Remen, Karen Armstrong, Mary Pfeiffer, and others. Well, why would we want to spend more time in the worlds of troubles that we have known? As one of my favorite sayings attributed to Sigmund Freud says, pain is bad, avoid it when you can. But the point is, we cannot avoid painful times in our lives. They happen to everyone. As Elaine Pagels says in her new book, Why Religion? Suffering is not divine punishment, but an essential part of life that binds us together because we all share in it. And Mark Twain tells us, what is joy without sorrow? What is success without failure? What is a win without a loss? What is health without illness? You have to experience each if you are to appreciate the other. There's always going to be suffering. It is how you look at your suffering, how you deal with it, that will define you. Difficult times happen in all of our lives. They're one of the things we all have, each in our own way, and that create a common ground that we all share. And we all have choices about how we deal with the hard times when we face them. And here's where I get stuck, because I gravitated towards this subject because I believe it's important, and I believe it's difficult to talk about. And I have sat with here with you many times, hearing about inspirational people who have overcome great obstacles, some they faced from the world they live in, and some from inside themselves. Their creative and persistent and historic lives are models in many ways. But who among us feels heroic when things just don't seem like they're working? One thing I do not want to do is make this a bootstraps talk. You know, it's time to bend over, grab your own bootstraps, and pull yourself up. I think that's rubbish. Also, there's so many varieties of hard times, I don't want to pretend that I have any universal solution. But I do believe that the hard times we face are times to focus on safety, self-respect, and self-care. I believe that the hardness is a strong motivator for learning experiences and personal growth, and that how we respond to crisis moments in each of our lives defines much of who and what we are. I also believe that in those times when things just do not seem to be working, we often find that the life views we hold do not work as well, and that we need a different, often larger worldview. And as long as that changing life view has self-care in first place, I will agree with the words from the movie Jaws. We need a bigger boat. Mary Pfeiffer tells us that many people politely fall apart at some point in their lives, and how they regroup and move on determines what their future will be. She says, all experiences can be redemptive if we ask, what did I learn from this? But she also says, not all people grow from crises. Those who do grow manage to stay awake to the anguish, confusion, and self-doubt. This requires a high tolerance for discomfort, as well as the ability to see the world as it is and not as we wish it to be. Over time, people who continue the struggle emerge wiser, kinder, and more resilient. And having broken and rebuilt themselves, they feel less breakable. Rachel Remen talks about learning and personal growth that comes from facing hard times when she says, if, as Ram Dass suggests, life is the ultimate teacher, we cannot learn unless we attend school. This usually means allowing ourselves to be touched by life, to participate in it. The important thing about many of the strategies we use to shelter ourselves from feeling loss is that none acknowledges our capacity for finding meaning or wisdom. Pain often marks the place where self-knowledge and growth can happen. And religion is one of place of refuge for many people during hard times, but religion is not always helpful or even constructive. Mustafa Aykal, in a New York Times op-ed, poses the question, does religion make people moral? Says, it depends. Religion can work in two fundamentally different ways. It can be a source of self-education, or it can be a source of self-gratification. Self-education can make people more moral. Religious texts often have moral teachings with which people can question and instruct themselves. The Quran, just like the Bible, has such pearls of wisdom. It tells believers to uphold justice, even against yourselves or your parents or relatives. It praises those who control their wrath and are forgiving toward mankind. It counsels, repel evil with what is better so your enemy will become a bosom friend. A person who follows such virtuous teachings will likely develop a moral character, just as a person who follows similar teachings in the Bible will. But trying to nurture moral values is one thing, and assuming that you are already moral and virtuous simply because you identify with a particular religion is another. The latter turns religion into a tool for self-glorification. And when a religion's adherents assume themselves to be moral by default, they never bother to question themselves. At the same time, they look down on other people as misguided souls, if not wicked infidels. For such people, religion works not as a cure for the soul, but as a drug for the ego. It makes them not humble, but arrogant. Karen Armstrong gives us what I think of as a progressive, very Unitarianish version of what religion can do. In most traditions, faith is not about belief, but about practice. Religion is not about believing 20 impossible things before breakfast, but about doing things that can change you. It is a moral aesthetic, an ethical alchemy. If you behave in a certain way, you will be transformed. The myths and laws of religions are not true because they conform to some metaphysical, scientific, or historical reality, but because they are life-enhancing. They tell about how human nature functions, but we will not discover the truth unless we apply these myths and doctrines to our own lives and put them into practice. The myths of the hero, for example, are not meant to give us historical information about Prometheus or Achilles, or for that matter, about Jesus or Buddha. Their purpose is to compel us to act in such a way that we bring out our own historic potential. In a secular version, Matt Haig, in Notes on a Nervous Planet, gives us a warning about how easy it is to let others make our world a smaller place. His piece is called Algorithms Eat Empathy. Now, thanks to clever algorithms, when we do our shopping, we are presented with lots of other things that we might like. Things that people like us would buy. If we're on Spotify or YouTube listening to music, they present us with a list of music that is almost exactly like the music we're already listening to. If we're on Amazon, we are shown the books that people who bought this book also bought. If we're on social media, we're told to follow more people like the people we already follow, more like us. We're encouraged to stay in our zone and play it safe, because the internet companies know that on average, most people generally listen to and read and watch and eat and wear the kind of stuff they have already read and watched and eaten and worn. But all through history, we weren't able to do that. We had to go out and compromise and deal with people who weren't like us, with things that weren't like the things we like. And it was horrid. But now it might be even worse, because differences become something to fear and sneer at, not celebrate. People with similar views end up falling out, unable to stomach even the slightest difference of opinion, until we're trapped in an echo chamber of one, reading a million versions of the same book, listening to the same song, and retweeting our own opinions until the end of time. But we are humans. We can resist this. We can resist to being confined to a little digital tribe. We can embrace life at its full bandwidth. We are finding ways to do so all the time. Yes, it might be a mess, but our strength is our messiness. We don't do things simply because they make sense. The internet can be our ally, not our enemy in this. The internet contains a whole world. The internet can be what we want it to be. The internet can lead us anywhere we choose. We just have to make sure that we, not the technology, not the designers and engineers able to manipulate our every mood, are the ones doing the choosing. In my own hard times, I consider my first rule of self-care in the word of Douglas Adams from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy: don't panic. Also, we learn from hard times more than any other time who our real friends and real communities are and who are not. One of my own hard times came from a rigid and authoritarian evangelical upbringing, but even that gave me much in return. As Abuelita says in Erica Baumeister's School of Essential Ingredients, sometimes our greatest gifts come from what we are not given. From the time I was a child and went to school, I was not allowed to participate in holidays or birthdays. I did not recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, and I did not stand for the national anthem. I understood that was what my family did. I don't remember particularly that I'm feeling that I missed out, but I did learn from this that I would stand up for what I believed was right, even if it meant being different than others, and even if it meant being excluded, or if I experienced negative consequences, and that has served me well all my life. The religion taught control, isolation, and fear. We were discouraged from dealing with people outside of the religion except for trying to convert them. Education beyond high school, though not absolutely forbidden, was considered a sign of spiritual weakness and was strongly discouraged. But I loved learning, and I felt that I could go on in my education for the greater glory of God. I had to arrange to pay for it all, as my family did not support my decision in any way. And my mother was called before the elders and asked if she had encouraged me in any way. She hadn't. To try to prove that I was not acting out of rebellion against the religion, I spent most of my summer after high school doing full-time church work, proselytizing from door to door. And at the end of that summer, we had an assembly. The church would rent a fairgrounds, and many congregations would meet there with morning, afternoon, and evening sessions where we were told the things the organization wanted us to know. I remember at the end of the assembly that I was absolutely sure, to the very core of my being, that this old wicked system things would not last very long and that it was a waste of time for me to go to college. But I also knew I would keep my commitment to go to college for the first year. Then I would quit and do God's work full time. I only hoped that the wicked world would last out my first year in college before God destroyed it, saving only the true believers of this religion. There was no doubt whatsoever in my mind or in my heart that all of that was the truth. And that was over 50 years ago. Fortunately, I did go to college that first year. It was a year of feeling disoriented and almost shell-shocked, but fascinated at the same time. My eyes started to open, and at the end of the year, I knew I would continue. By the end of my second year in college, I had stopped going to the church meetings. I wasn't sure if it was the true religion or not, but I knew I couldn't pretend if I wasn't sure. It took years for me to get the lesson from this about how damaging certainty can be, and the words of a Bermuda friend, John Milligan White. Knowing everything, an often unrecognized requirement for certainty, is beyond the human capacity. This experience has led me to a lifelong interest in critical thinking, cognitive bias, and self-deception. Then the night terror started. I would half wake at night feeling that something was trying to smother me. I believed that I had left God's protection and that the demons were coming to get me. In my half-awake state, I was very vulnerable and very frightened. I don't remember exactly how long this went on until one week I woke up enough to say, "Piss off." And the night terrors vanished and they never returned. This sort of thing happens a lot to people who try to leave the religion. And I found out from this that courage is not about being fearless, but it's about being fearful and still doing the right thing. And I also found out that sometimes saying "piss off" is the right thing to do. As I grew away from that religion, my family, who were still members, did what they were expected to do. At first, I was tolerated with some scorn, and eventually I was shunned by my sister. I have met other former members of the religion who have been shunned by family members. Some, heartbreakingly, have lost their own children the same way I lost my sister. I have grieved for her, and I've come to understand over the 40 plus years she has done this, that she is lost to me forever. I learned from this that a person is defined even more by what they choose to hate than they are by what they love. And I learned what it does to a person when they decide to give the power of what to hate to a person or group. What it does to a person to choose to hate on command or even on suggestion. One result of that behavior by my family is that I had to pick more mature, kind-hearted, and wise people than I might otherwise have chosen as friends. It's easy for people to see someone who is treated badly by family and believe that person must have done something very wrong to deserve such treatment. I had to find people who could see beyond my family's treatment of me, and being around these kind-hearted and caring people helped me to shape my adult life in a kinder and more open-minded way. Finally, I've had to deal with members of this religion in order to maintain my relationship with my mother. She deserves more credit than can be imagined for managing to stay connected to me in spite of many of her church elders pressuring her to turn away. My sister even rejected her, even though they shared the same religion. And when my mother could not live alone anymore, she accepted my and my husband's offer to come here and live with us on our farm. I remember shortly after she arrived here, the church elders came to call on me. It was clear they were trying to decide if they should tell her that she must disown me or turn away from me. She was still devoted to the religion, but she was also moderately advanced in her dementia. I sat and listened to those men and kept saying to myself that my goal was to look after and to love my mother and that nothing else matters. It was, keep your eyes on the prize, keep your eyes on the prize. And for whatever reason, they decided to allow her to live with us and allowed me to care for her. We had 8 years before she died, and in the end, love and kindness won. Without these experiences and struggles, I would not be the person I am today. I very likely would have settled for less, expecting less of myself and less for myself. My life is forever richer, kinder, and more meaningful because of these hard times. And without these hard times, though I would not wish them on anyone ever, I very likely would never have found my spiritual home here with you. The next reading is from a story written by a friend of mine called Anupriya and the Lotus Flower in the Early Morning Sunshine. And it begins with many of the questions we may ask ourselves as we struggle with hard times. Where is illumination found? Where can I find truth? Where is meaning found? Where is my soul's home? It is not something that is found, for it was never lost. It is slowly unwrapped and uncovered. It surrounds our every moment. It guides our every movement. It is part of the dirt, the moss, the lake, the spices, the people, and the fire. It glimmers like a flame, yet is impossible to catch. It is the energy source from which all religion and philosophy stems. We are bound to it as it is to us. We carry our torches into the darkness. We display regret and patience. Time stops, illusions melt, and we step into the eternal presence. And I'll conclude with Mary Pfeiffer, who says, "We all share similar journeys. We live through childhoods filled with ups and downs. We share houses with people who love us and make us miserable. We pass developmental milestones and accomplish important goals. We fail miserably. We make the best of it. We take turns being the afflicted and the comforter. We experience a crisis and realize our own ways are not working. We stumble around lost and happy and unhappy, only to see the light, find our new path, and move forward. This is our universal story. And now, if you will join, standing in body or spirit for hymn 131, Love Will Guide Us. Now, for those of you who wondered what happened to Jane Austen, here she comes in the closing words. She is channeled through Alexander McCall Smith in his modern rewrite of Jane's classic Emma. And Emma was happy. She realized that happiness is something that springs from the generous treatment of others, or that until one makes that connection, happiness may prove elusive. In Italy with George, that thought came even more forcefully to her when, in a small art gallery in an obscure provincial town well off the beaten track, she saw a 17th century picture of a young man giving his hand to a young woman. And the young woman takes it and holds it, cherishing it as one might cherish something as fragile and vulnerable and very precious. The eyes of the woman are not on the man, nor upon the hand she holds, but fixed on the one who views the painting, and they convey, as do so many things, figures in art that say anything to us, this message. You do it too.
So, as we extinguish the chalice, would you read aloud along with me this passage from a poem dedicated to the garbage men of Bloomington, Illinois, on New Year's Day. O garbage man, the new year greets you like the old. After this first run, you may rest beds like gray, warm apron laps, and know that people everywhere have faith. Putting from them all things of this world, they confidently bide your second coming. So let us form a circle holding hands and sing our circle song, the words on the wall there.